Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's amazing what can happen over the course of a few months. Not long ago, Biden was emphatic that the U.S. would back Ukraine as long as it takes. Now it is as long as we can. What happened? No doubt the regime in Kyiv has taken note. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Lazar, in New York. He is a journalist and author of three books on the U.S. Constitution. In Mount Jackson, we have Karen Kwiatkowski. She is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, having served at both NSA and the Office of Secretary of Defense. And in Tulsa, we cross to Jeremy Kuzmarov. He is managing editor of Covert Action magazine. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first in New York. So what happened? As long as we can. I don't know how many people have picked up on it, but it's a huge discursive change.
Well, the war is not going very well from a U.S. point of view, and it's no fun losing a war. So when that happens, the temptation is very great to sort of walk away from the mess and let others clean it up, and that's what the U.S. is doing. Biden is bogged down. He's got two wars in his hands. He's got a major crisis on the southern border. He has a Republican revolt in Congress, which is essentially paralyzing his administration. And he's trying to figure out a way of extricating himself from the mess. But it's not very clear that there is a way out. So he is stuck. And certainly aid to the Ukraine may very well wind up on the cutting room floor.
Well, you know, Karen, it seems to me, shifting from as long as it takes, as long as we can, we're going into the finger-pointing mode now. It's, you know, who's to blame? You know, House Republicans, because there's other important issues in the Middle East. I mean, Zelensky isn't measuring up. I mean, they're looking for someone to be the bag mag here in the end. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, well, I mean, the American people and the Congress, to a great extent, has been lied to about the progress of war. And since those lies can no longer be sustained, the war has never been going well for Ukraine, and it's certainly in a much worse position today for negotiations or for a peace settlement than it was a year ago or even 2 years ago. So this reality is coming into the picture, and we're seeing it on the front pages of the papers. The finger-pointing is not just political, but it is being transmitted to the country to kind of prepare Americans for the fact that this is over. And it's an election year.
Yeah, but what's really interesting here is that these people, they think they're clever, but they're not, Jeremy, because they're just redefining it. I mean, last summer, Biden said Russia's already lost a war. Blinken said exactly the same thing. They're not addressing reality. They're just trying to put a different spin on it here. Because now what they're talking about is a frozen conflict, as if Russia would go along with it. They never address that part of the equation. Ukraine should go for a frozen conflict, like in Korea. We heard this a year ago, okay? I mean, they're recycling their own talking points now. Jeremy.
Well, and look at the human tragedy as they're doing this. I mean, thousands of people are dying. You know, there was an article yesterday in the New York Times about Kherson, and Ukrainian commander said this is a suicide mission, you know. So there was another article in the same issue, how they're basically kidnapping people in Kyiv to send them to the front line. You know, Ukrainians don't want to serve in this war. I mean, for a long time, I think that's been true. That's why they had to rely on these militias, you know, privately financed militias, many of them political extremists. And now they're resorting to press ganging people into the Ukrainian military. So, you know, this is getting really, really ugly. The other story is how, I mean, Russia's economy, I think a main motive of the war was to grind Russia into a quagmire and devastate their economy by ratcheting up the sanctions. But clearly, Putin has been very bold, and Russia has survived economically and is flourishing in many ways. And there was an article today in today's New York Times about how all these American companies, you know, Putin shrewdly kind of took them over and made this into a profit, how all these American companies were exiting. So that part of the strategy has failed. You know, the U.S. thought that they would initiate a regime change operation by making Putin look bad and ruining the Russian economy, and that's not working out now.
Yeah, but so, it's interesting, Daniel, on the tail end of what Jeremy just said there, all this political calculation about what would happen, what could happen, they've been wrong every single time, but they're still making these policies as if they're going to get some kind of win at the end. You can change the language all you want, change the words all you want, but it doesn't change the reality on the ground, and that's what they don't get. Daniel.
Well, the strategic thinking in Washington has been extraordinarily bad. And Joe Biden personally has been on the wrong end of these decisions repeatedly. I mean, he personally championed the war in Afghanistan, which, of course, ended disastrously, shortly into his new administration. He championed the invasion of Iraq, intervention in Libya, the proxy war in Syria, and then the war in the Ukraine. And the U.S. virtually engineered this war from the start. Yeah. The U.S. promoted the 2013-14 Maidan coup, which tore the country apart and made a conflict more or less inevitable. And Joe Biden was in the thick of this. They thought they could win that war easily. They thought they could crush Putin, take over the vast natural resources of Central Asia, confront China from both ends, from the east and the west. This was these big new Brzezinski strategy that was laid out in his 1998 bestseller called The Grand Chessboard. And it is failing. It is failing. The U.S. essentially is overstretched, overreached, and now it's reaching the limits of its power.
Yeah, and it's believing its own propaganda as well. You know, Karen, in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article about an unclassified, of course it was leaked, but it's not attached to anyone's name, that Russia has lost up to 90% of its forces involved in the original special military operation. 90%. So why does Ukraine need money? And why would anyone think that Russia is going to invade a NATO country if it lost 90% of its army? They have these two narratives going on simultaneously. It doesn't make any sense. Go ahead, Karen.
Well, it makes sense because they're promoting a war globally. They're promoting a war in Europe. We're cheerleading this war. We're cheerleading it to the American people. So they need different stories for different audiences. We've seen NATO do the same thing. NATO says, "Oh, we're really tough. We're so powerful." And then the very next sentence, "But Russia's going to invade, and they're going all the way to Paris," or whatever it is they say. So these stories are aimed at domestic populations for the most part, because ultimately it is the Europeans and the American taxpayer who has to pay for this or go bankrupt trying to. So the messaging. There's actually probably two wars going on, at least in Washington. One is against their own people, and the propaganda war against the world. And then, of course, the exercise of our military industry. They sell the aid to Ukraine is sold to Americans, not as helping Ukraine win 100%, of course, but mainly because it creates jobs in America. I mean, Biden just recently started talking about, don't worry, people, it's all about your jobs. So, I will say the Brzezinski Doctrine has been something that American politicians for decades have clung to as if it was God's promise to the earth. And it's not. It hasn't worked. It isn't working. It's impossible to sustain. And it's based on a false premise, certainly.
Well, but one thing does work, Jeremy. One thing does work. Instead of selling this as a jobs project, which is kind of creepy, it's cringe if you think about it. War is good for business. I can't believe that they're trying to sell it, but they are. But it is very profitable. Now, there's no doubt about that for a very small number of shareholders, Jeremy.
Well, yeah, it's profitable for the weapons contractor. I mean, it's basically been a boondoggle for the, major defense contractors and for the Wall Street, hedge funds that own them, like BlackRock. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said this several times. I heard him say it. And that's really what this amounts to, along with other American wars. I mean, there's really no value to these wars. I think the American people see that. The soldiers see that. I mean, there's so much cynicism now in America. And I think, it's a very dangerous moment in American history because that cynicism is fueling the rise of, neo-fascism, the Trumpite movement. So I think it's just a very dangerous situation. And yeah, we're seeing the denouement of the American empire crashing and burning, hopefully not taking everybody down with it.
Yeah, but Daniel, it kind of dropped out of the discourse, but then it reemerged here, is to fight for democracy in Ukraine. Do you know anything about democracy in Ukraine? Because I can't find it.
Well, the Ukraine is a country which is deeply unstable. It's unstable in many respects. It's divided by language. It has a huge breakaway section. There's a far right nationalist culture in the Western Ukraine, which essentially dominates the country as a whole. But the mix is very volatile, and no one knows how it'll play out. And that's what makes the situation on the military front so dangerous. The problem is not necessarily a stalemate lasting for years and years, but a collapse. Yeah. If the Ukrainian lines break and there's a major Russian advance, well, that'll mean, number one, a defeat for the government in Kiev and Zelensky. But it'll also mean, very possibly, civil war conditions inside the Ukraine.
That's
itself.
Exactly what I've been predicting for months now, that once we see some kind of outcome on the battlefield, we're going to see an internal breakdown, and maybe both at the same time. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Karen in Mount Jackson. Over the last, I think, about 2 months, we have seen the word stalemate being played out. And it's actually, in the West, the Western powers that be, they kind of use it as a positive. At least Ukraine hasn't lost. That's how they're spinning it here. But it really isn't a stalemate. It's a growing defeat for Ukraine, because as much frustration as there is with Russia's strategy with the special military operation, and I've expressed it personally on this program here, but if in the larger thing, if you're 40,000 feet in the air, it's working. Let the Ukrainian military come to the Russian forces to be annihilated. And that's exactly what's been going on for a good part of 20 months right now. That policy is working. As impatient it makes us all feel, because I want to see this come to an end. I see this war is completely senseless. So many young men being destroyed for a war that never should have happened. But essentially, the Russian plan of destroying the military capacity of a NATO-backed military is happening. Karen.
It is happening. And I think this is partly why NATO wants it to stop before it becomes even more obvious the real danger that NATO presents by stoking and picking fights that it can't even fight, much less prevail in. So, it's a huge problem. But yeah, Ukraine, I think 6 to 7 million people, many women and children, have left the country. Of course, they're in various parts of Europe and around the world as, I guess, refugees, immigrants. But many of them are not returning. Many of them are not planning to return. The Donbass area will stay Russian. So they've lost the population and the industry that was in the east. So Ukraine is fractured. It's fractured in a material way, in a territorial way. It's politically fractured. And you mentioned democracy. What democracy? Zelensky has banned religions. He's suspended political parties, jailed his political opponents. And the mayor of Kiev is so frustrated that he's publicly spoken about Zelensky's corruption and poor leadership. So that country is being destroyed from inside and outside. Honestly, to me, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not Russian, I'm not Ukrainian, but the Russians seem to have been restrained in the way they've approached this whole thing. They have, because in a traditional war fighting scenario, now's the time to strike and take it completely off the map. And they're not doing that. Russia is not doing that. They've never wanted to do that. That's not part of Putin's agenda. It's not part of the Russian army's agenda. But they could. And the very fact that they could, after all of the money the West has poured in, after all of the global sanctions and all of the efforts that we've made to back up, this is not just a small loss. It's not a stalemate. This is a major defeat of the West.
Yeah,
it's a defeat
yeah.
of their forces and of their military.
You know, the juxtaposition, of course, is what the Israelis are doing to Gaza. That's what total war looks like, and a genocidal
exactly.
war at that. As we're speaking right now, people are drinking cappuccinos in Kyiv, okay? That's the difference, all right? Jeremy,
yes.
it seems to me, because elections always play a role in decision-making here, and given that the Congress is unwilling, at least at this point, Ukraine will keep getting money, $60 billion. I don't think so. But the administration is going to keep the spigot on it, just that it's not going to be so full blast here. And, this is what life support approach. This is what the Biden administration will have, at least up until the election. Agree?
Well, I agree. Yeah, and to add to what Karen was saying, also they've been assassinating, not just jailing. They assassinated the head of the Socialist Party in Parliament in Moscow. This is a mafia regime in Ukraine. There have been wide-scale assassinations extending into Russia. And yeah, it's really a trick of George Orwell that this is presented and believed by many in the liberal community in the United States that this is some great democracy and great fight for democracy. Now, to answer your question, Biden is committed, I think, to the hilt, and they'll find a way. And I mean, look what happened in the 80s with the Contra War. When Congress cut off aid, what did they do? They found covert ways to continuously arm the Contras. And I think there are a lot of parallels. The Contras were the terrorist organization intent on sabotaging Nicaragua and the Sandinistas. And I think Ukraine is basically a mafia regime with terrorist adjunct like the Azov Battalion. And I think that they'll find ways to fund them covertly if Congress cuts off aid. You know, the so-called deep state, you know, the Pentagon, the real power brokers. And they can also use other countries, third countries. They've done historically when regime become really unpopular and pariahs. They find other countries. Often Israel has done that work to arm them. So I think this may continue kind of low intensity conflict for a long time, unfortunately.
You know, Daniel, with the love affair with Zelensky seems to be fading away. I mean, a year ago he was in front of Congress, and much to my chagrin, seeing major party officials carrying a foreign flag in the Congress should offend everyone. At least it did me here. But we had a few months ago The Economist and Time magazine, not the most charitable reviews of Zelensky. And then with his latest trip to Washington, he returned home essentially empty-handed. I know $200 million is a lot. I'd like it. But when considering what he's got in the past, that's chump change here. Zelensky's more or less done. I mean, if he's not the rainmaker, that's a financial term, to make money, what value is he to Ukraine? Daniel.
Well, you're right. His rainmaking powers are diminishing, so he's not of much value anymore. But the real issue is the U.S. I mean, Zelensky is a U.S. instrument. The U.S. put him in power. They arranged for him to head up this U.S.-funded military. Now the U.S. is getting tired. It's getting bored. It has other conflicts on its hands. And so it's walking away. And I think that that disaster is looming. I think this is going to be an extremely dangerous situation in the Ukraine and in Europe as well.
Yep.
I think the future of NATO is in real question. And the U.S. has no idea how to deal with it. There's diminishing confidence in the Biden administration. His numbers are plunging. everyone's, you know, preparing themselves for a Trump presidency 2.0, and Trump will certainly seek to put NATO on an entirely new footing. And NATO itself, the European allies, are just like, you know, shaking their heads and wondering what it all means. And it's going to mean a very big change. 2024 is going to be a very big year.
It's going to be very turbulent, to say the least. Yeah. Karen, you know, it's really interesting. I'm glad we started talking about NATO and Trump here, because, of course, you know, the scaremongering, Trump will take the U.S. out of NATO, you know, and they passed in Congress, you know, amendments, so he can't do it and all, which constitutionally, I think, is quite dubious. But what's really interesting is that Joe Biden has damaged NATO more than Trump ever possibly could, because he's presiding over a strategic defeat for the alliance. Karen.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And, you know, history and the truth sometimes takes a little time to evolve as we look at what happened in the past couple of years, certainly in Europe with regards to NATO, with American policy. When we look at that, the mistakes are going to be really obvious as to what has happened here. But yeah, Biden, and it's not clear Biden's leading the country. I mean, the man is clearly senile. You know, he's drugged up. He's not mentally leading the country there, but the people around him, the neoconservatives around him, are driving American foreign policy. And they have never seen a wall they didn't want to drive into. And they're doing it again. They never take responsibility for their mistakes. However, the reckoning time is coming, because Europe can't sustain NATO without the United States money. And many European countries are over indebted. They're going broke. Demographics are not right to raise huge armies. Same goes for the United States, and we're more broke than they are. So as the reckoning comes, both the financial reckoning, a political reckoning, and, you know, we can talk about Trump and we don't like Trump, but Trump represents the same populist movement that is boistering and buoying up RFK Jr. and other candidates. People in America are tired of war, and they're tired of their limited money going to destroy the rest of the world while not defending or even repairing our roads and bridges. I mean, This is a populist concern that's shared across all parties. The actual voters in all parties share this view. So yes, 2024 is going to be very, very exciting. And I'll tell you, the elites in this country, Washington, D.C., our Congress that is so worried that Trump's going to get elected and the first thing he's going to do is pull out of NATO, they are panicking. And I think for the rest of us, and while it's a tragedy, what we're seeing and what we've seen in Ukraine, and certainly a tragedy in Gaza, there are some things coming to America that are going to kind of tilt the balance of justice in some ways. I think this country.
I think it's also true, and just we're rapidly running out of time, Jeremy. But you know, the failures of these neoliberal elites are fueling the rise of populism, right wing populism in Europe. I mean, this is the best thing that could happen to the populace in Europe, the way these people are running this war and their economies, and I would say their cultures. That's a different topic. Jeremy, finish it off for us. Go ahead.
Well, we could also be entering an era of greater authoritarianism and repression, because populations are unhappy. There's growing revolts, including in Western countries, and the elites may react the way they know how. You know, what they've been doing all around the world, a lot of the violence may come home here, and we may see more and more repression and more of a police state. And that's one of the dangers as people rise up, because clearly, as Karen pointed out, people are not happy with these policies. These policies are a failure. I mean, it's a failure of governance. They're not governing for the American people. They're causing mayhem abroad, and there's going to be more and more rebellions, and we hope that they don't unleash their wrath on the American people.
Well, we know that their first line of resort is censorship. That's what they're very, very good at doing, censoring us and disappearing us. And we're going to have to fight back against that. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Mount Jackson, New York, and in Tulsa. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.